This is Angpula. I'm Sonam Yangjin. Welcome to the RIX podcast. We're happy to bring this 4-episode series on artificial intelligence. I would like to welcome my colleague, Ishi Omdendup, who is a researcher at RIX, to present this series. We hope you enjoy listening to it. On December 17, 2023, marking a significant moment in the history of Bhutan, His Majesty the King officially announced the establishment of the Gelafu Mindfulness City. Highlighting GMC's significant role in steering Bhutan's future, His Majesty underscored that Bhutan is at an inflection point. Today, the world is experiencing another inflection point, one brought about by the AI revolution. With the unprecedented rate at which AI is evolving, humanity finds itself at a pivotal juncture, trying to balance between the significant opportunities and the profound challenges that AI poses. To delve into these further, we present the RIX podcast series on artificial intelligence. In this 4-part series, we will unpack the complexities of AI by engaging with experts from various fields who bring with them their diverse perspectives and experiences with AI. The advent of AI has brought about innumerable opportunities for humanity, but not without its equally, if not more, daunting challenges. Leading AI experts have expressed concerns about AI's potential existential threats to humanity. Conversely, there is a different school of thought that dismisses these concerns as mere scaremongering, akin to something out of a fictional movie plot. While the debate over AI's catastrophic potential continues, one thing is certain. The rapid advancement of AI calls for the need to balance innovation and ethical responsibility while educating citizens on its responsible use. Hence, for the first episode of the 4-part RIX podcast series on artificial intelligence, we will explore the role of responsible AI and AI literacy in Bhutan's development with Manail Anis Ahmed. Manail is an expert in public digital infrastructure and AI governance, who is dedicated to advancing responsible AI and AI literacy globally. She is a visiting faculty at Princeton University, where she designed and taught the university's first course on responsible AI. She leads a global research group at the Center for AI and Digital Policy and co-founded iJuno.io, an AI-powered home and family management startup. As a Public Voices Fellow for Equality Now, she works to advance the rights of women and girls globally. Welcome to the RIX podcast, Manail. It's truly an honor to have you here today. Manail, you've been a prominent advocate for responsible AI. So how do you define responsible AI, and what steps can private entities and governments take to achieve it effectively?
Sure. First of all, thank you so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be speaking to the beautiful country of Bhutan as you develop your AI and national digital strategy. Responsible AI is simply AI that is created based on good data. It's used for the larger good, or at the very least, it's not used for harm, and it does not exploit people or the planet for financial gain. So to answer your question about what private entities can do to effectively achieve it, private entities have lots of work to do. And perhaps they may not be able to do it because at the base of things, they have a profit motive, and this becomes a conundrum. I'll explain how in a little bit. However, government entities do have a duty to achieve it, because by definition, governments are meant to serve their citizens and protect them. So in the context of governance, you may want to ask, what is responsible AI? And in order to understand that, we have to first understand what it is about AI that may make it irresponsible. There's a number of things that are immediate, or at least proximate. data and all the associated problems with data, such as availability, provenance, bias, ownership, and so on. Resource costs that go into the developmental component of AI, including human, social, environmental, and financial. Then the usage and deployment of AI for financial gain. The injustice, harm, or negative outcomes caused as a result of the deployment or usage of AI. Over the longer term, the cultural and social impact of the usage of AI. And of course, in systemic terms, strengthening the techno-feudal economic system, where we all, as the human race, become serfs in the fiefdom of big technology companies. So then, what is responsible AI? It's technology that follows existing rules. So for instance, if a country has rules about stealing, which most countries do, then AI shouldn't be built on stolen data, which means that data needs to be treated like other, more tangible property and protected. By extension, if a country has rules about not wasting natural resources, which I know that Bhutan does, then the AI should be created with that consciousness in mind. So if it's not being developed in Bhutan, but only used in it, then wherever it is being maintained and is incurring a resource cost, the countries that are using it should be doing their bit to offset those resource costs. So again, it shouldn't be deployed for outsized financial gain. It shouldn't be causing harm, injustice, or negative externalities. It shouldn't have an erosive or destructive effect on society. And the very least, or the bottom line, it shouldn't be helping prop up the prevailing extractive capitalist system that we seem to be living in.
Definitely, governments do play a very pivotal role in ensuring that AI is being developed and deployed for good, like you highlighted, be it through implementing robust regulations or through any other means. And we all know that AI brings tremendous potential to various sectors in the society, but it also poses equally, if not more, significant ethical and societal challenges. So how can understanding and implementing responsible AI help address these issues in the country specifically?
Yeah, absolutely. So it takes a little bit of work to understand what the ethical and social challenges of AI are. First of all, we're very used to thinking that technology is something that floats in the air and floats over to us over a cloud. We're not used to thinking about the actual physical resource costs that are involved. The storage of data takes servers, which are housed somewhere physically. Those servers need maintenance, they need electricity, they need cooling, they need wiring, they need circuitry, and all of those things incur a physical resource cost. Then the very fact that each time we use, let's say, a large language model, we are using a certain amount of water to cool the circuitry that goes into the processing of the large language model. And that water is coming at the expense of perhaps clean drinking water in another country. There's some very basic social and ethical challenges that we all need to understand. And I don't think that there is a very widespread understanding of this. But I think beyond these basic challenges, it can cause bias, it can do social injustice, it can impact cultural change, it can cause an erosion of values. There are some larger considerations that I think we as users, but also as governments and policymakers need to keep in mind. And one of those things is quite simply that AI can do a few interesting and useful things, right? Mostly to do with productivity, optimization, workflow improvement. So how does it do that? It does that by way of prediction making or decision support. But also, you can use AI as a tool to actually upskill people to build other kinds of technologies, other kinds of software, other kinds of, you know, entire industries maybe. And so as a government, what are you thinking AI will do for you? What is it that you want it to do for you? How do you want to use it? And then when you make that decision on a country level, how do you bring in responsible AI, as you said, to address those challenges? Well, one of the major challenges that we're staring at down the line is job displacement, right? If AI is writing essays, creating code, doing customer service tasks, providing data analysis, then that already precludes anyone from entering the workforce to be doing those jobs, because what we're hearing is that AI will take over those jobs. On the other hand, we're achieving efficiencies. So again, from a responsible AI perspective, are we sufficiently prepared to achieve those efficiencies as we stare at the social and ethical concerns that AI is presenting to us? So again, I would ask the question, are we weighing the true value creation of AI against its negative externalities. There's an economist from MIT called Daron Acemoglu, and he calls AI a so-so technology. What is its real value? It hasn't yet been proven. Sometimes he compares it to automated checkout counters, which, as you may have heard, in the US are being phased out. Right? There was all this optimism around automated checkout counters, and now they're saying, well, it displaces people from jobs, but also it encourages people to steal, so there's more theft. At the end of the day, it's not as revolutionary a technology as we thought it would be. And so when we talk about responsible AI, we think about responsible AI, we want to think about what is the true value creation. And at this point, I have to be honest, we are too early in the cycle to actually know the answer.
All right, thank you. That was a lot to digest, but some very profound insights indeed. Moving on, you've designed and facilitated courses on responsible AI and AI literacy. Can you please share some insights into how your experience on designing and facilitating these courses were? And apart from the formal education system, how else can governments effectively communicate the benefits and risks of AI to their citizens? Like you mentioned earlier, it is difficult to weigh on the benefits and or the negative implications of AI, but I think it is also equally important to advocate and communicate that to your citizens and to the users of these technologies. So how can governments do that?
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. I'll try to answer the first part first and then follow that up in sequence. So I really started designing courses in responsible AI and AI literacy because I wanted to understand it myself. And the reason for that was that I have never been technically trained. I'm not from a computer science background. I have a very basic understanding of data science, and I just wanted to know what all the fuss and the noise was about. And I realized that there was no easy way for even a decently educated person like me to get that education. And so as a result of my own learning journey, I started building out really an informal syllabus and curriculum. And then I was lucky enough to find a place where I could actually teach it, deliver it to student audiences. So designing courses is entirely context dependent, right? And I've developed courses for various audiences, including undergraduate students, working professionals in various industries such as finance, PR and communications, marketing, social technology, and entrepreneurship. I've designed courses for lifelong learners, policymakers, government officials, and civil servants. And I would say that the hardest part of doing all of this is keeping ahead of the research. There is so much literature that is emerging on AI and so many nascent trends that we don't yet have an understanding for. And so from a teaching perspective purely, it's quite difficult to keep up with the trends. But nevertheless, I think what is useful is being able to impart to any student or any learner the equipment to be able to recognize and forecast trends and to extrapolate from them. And so for that, you really need a general view of society, a larger view of the economy, what's happening in the world, how does technology impact various other industries, what the geopolitical realities are at any given time. Those are really the things that are important. From a governmental perspective, how do you get citizenry upskilled in AI is, I think, a much more complicated question. And I understand that in Bhutan, the constitution guarantees the right to information for citizens and the right to freedom of transmission, broadcasting, expression to media organizations. Now, I understand that all of this may have been drafted before AI was so squarely in the public imagination, but I think that those guidelines still hold. And so I think what the government of Bhutan would, for instance, consider is a large-scale public literacy program that is communicated through wider communication channels such as television and media advertising, but also making use of whatever proprietary technological tools the government has at its disposal. And I know for a fact that there are some very successful projects underway for digital transformation in Bhutan.
Thank you. It is fascinating to hear about your course, and I hope to sit through it one day. you highlighted, AI definitely is a very complex topic, especially given the unprecedented rate at which this technology is evolving. But it is also clear that education definitely plays a very pivotal role in advocating for, or rather demystifying AI and promoting its ethical and responsible use to foster a more informed society. Moving on, so considering Bhutan's context, how can a small developing country like ours achieve responsible AI? And what benefits could this really bring to our country? Also, can you please share some examples from other countries that you think Bhutan can possibly learn from?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great question. It's a question that gets right to the heart of the utility of AI for various countries. But I would encourage us to zoom out and take a public awareness and public interest view. It's really important for the citizens of Bhutan to actually understand the technologies that impact their lives and what is at stake. Now, sitting here in the US, we already know that there is substantial social impact of technology. And given Bhutan's situation as a fairly traditional society, which has worked successfully to maintain and preserve its culture, but also ensure literacy, upskilling, general prosperity and happiness of its citizens, it's really important for people to understand how the social impact of technology can play out if not regulated in the right way. The other thing that I think is important is for policymakers in the government to recognize, what is AI actually good for? What are you thinking it will do for you? Are there certain applications? I know for a fact that Bhutan is doing certain very interesting projects, and they seem to be very useful and in the public interest. But ultimately, as a strategy, how do you want to use AI as a country? And then take from there where you think the useful applications would be. Let me just add that the education strategy of Bhutan says very little about its strategic plans for research development, right? And it's a wonderful strategy and it has worked. The literacy rate in Bhutan has risen very quickly, but there does not seem to be a direct connection between educating Bhutanese citizens and the deployment of AI. Perhaps there is a direct connection between education and digital literacy or digital inclusion, but it needs to be taken a step further than that. And for that, we really want to ask ourselves, what are the areas of research that are most relevant to Bhutan? So are there things about its geography, about its topography, about its demography, its position in the world, its geopolitical strategic significance? What are the things that Bhutan wants to talk about now? Let me give you some examples. There's the International Center for Integrated Mountain Development, and Bhutan is leading that research effort with, you know, all the Himalayan Hindu Kush countries. There's a Center for Bhutan and Gross National Happiness Studies. There's other Global Development Network funding for research centers in Bhutan. So all of these questions are being asked, but ultimately, what are the ones that are rising to prominence, and does AI hold any possibilities for helping answer those questions? If we dug down deeper, if we had more time, then I think we would find that there are plenty of applications that can benefit from AI. Then we want to ask ourselves a question, what is digitization in Bhutan, or in fact, in any country, aiming for? What is the government actually trying to achieve with it? Is there an imperative to cater to developmental goals? Is there an imperative to combine developmental goals with gross national happiness? Is improving healthcare a consideration? Does the country want to include AI in the educational upskilling conversation? How about the improvement of property rights or land records? How about a drive for efficiency in the provision of government services, benefits, welfare considerations? Then you want to think about how does gross national happiness, or the consideration for gross national happiness, impact AI? And conversely, how does AI, or how can AI potentially impact gross national happiness? Ultimately, I think if all these questions are being asked in the right spirit, we can start to imagine that AI could become the catalyst for a model where Bhutan leapfrogs in its development, right? Such as other countries have done with the help of other technologies, such as mobile technology. So I'm sorry to answer your question with a series of questions, but I think that these are the questions that are worth asking if we want to think about what is it that is a good, responsible use of AI that is in the public interest for Bhutan.
Absolutely. Like you rightly pointed out, as a country, we definitely need to understand the technologies that are impacting our lives and how we can leverage them for our benefit. And also the gap between education and the deployment of AI in Bhutan is, of course, it's prevalent. But I think it also has to do with how new and advanced this technology is for us. And being a resource-constrained country, it definitely is a big setback for us. But that being said, we are slowly getting there. Just recently, the GovTech agency launched the national strategy. So to ensure that, like you mentioned, AI is being used to address the societal issues and for the development of our country, including promoting GNH. So there is a lot of work to be done, like you pointed out, but I think we are also slowly getting there. And now, given Bhutan's unique socio-cultural and economic landscape and the transformative initiatives, which I'm sure you must have heard, the Gelifu Mindfulness City, do you think Bhutan should develop specific regulations for the ethical use of AI, or should we follow the innovate first and regulate later model?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's a question that everyone struggles with. Look, I am always of the opinion that innovation should be strongly supported. But I think that we are in a stage of historical development where we have seen enough negative outcomes. And so it is important to at least guard against the negative outcomes that are already obvious and that other countries in the world, you know, I mean, there's many, many countries in the world who are already regulating the development, the deployment, the effective use of AI in their countries. And I don't think that Bhutan should stay out of that conversation. Now, I will point out that one of the things that is extremely encouraging and very promising in Bhutan is the recent launch of the National Digital Identity. And the reason that this is so significant in terms of AI regulation is because National Digital Identity, unlike anywhere in the world that I at least am familiar with, in Bhutan is based on the block, which means that citizens' data is not stored on servers that are managed by private corporations, at least not in the way that data is generally managed. My understanding of blockchain is that this data management is extremely right, and it depends on authentication and verification. In that sense, you've really already circumvented a lot of the problems that accompany digital identity, data theft, data governance, data sovereignty, data provenance, data privacy. You're really more than halfway there to begin with, right? But at the same time, Bhutan has to ask itself, what further would the ethical use of AI mean? So would it simply mean that citizens' identities are protected? Or would it mean that discrimination and bias that has resulted in a widespread way with the use of AI in other countries will not be an outcome in Bhutan? And I don't think we can guarantee that, right? It's one thing to have secure citizens' data. It's another thing to prevent algorithms from causing discrimination. I think the biggest challenge for ethical AI is big tech and their inexorable large-scale data theft and data creep, right? All of us all over the world are impacted. So if Bhutan ends up being just another market or these big technology companies and the engagement economy in general, just like India or just like China, which are much larger, but on either side, then Bhutan is not protected from unethical AI. And this is bound to impact the citizens in some of the ways that I've already mentioned. So in that case, I think it is very important to start thinking about governing the ethical use of AI. Now, referring to the Gelifu Mindfulness City, this is a fascinating project. And it looks like there's not a lot out there in the public domain. I understand that it's very early stages, it's planning stages, and not a lot can be said. But I have worked together on, I have worked on another project developing a special economic zone in another country where I was responsible for setting up a college of business and entrepreneurship in that economic zone. And all I'm going to say is that with regard to ethical AI for a project like Gelifu Mindfulness City, we would really have to work together, put our heads together and work together at every stage of the process to figure out what would work for Bhutan, what would work for Gelifu, what would achieve its ultimate goals. So, for instance, are we looking only to match economic output with sustainability or resilience or happiness as Bhutan defines it? Can we actually meaningfully deploy mindfulness? Can we follow the principles of Vajrayana in a new economic zone? What is it? What does it truly mean? What does it mean in terms of metrics and achievable key performance indicators? And ultimately, is it bringing us to a point of compassion, of living in unison with nature, with each other, taking a circular view of history and a cyclical view of nature and society? If we're able to understand those things with the Gelfu Mindfulness City Project, then every city in Bhutan becomes a mindfulness city, right? But those metrics need to be unpacked, and this is an extremely large conversation. I think, you know, we could spend hours talking about this.
Thank you. That's definitely a very interesting perspective. So developing regulations early on could provide a structured pathway for AI integration, ensuring that Bhutan's values and societal norms are being promoted and preserved. That is what responsible AI basically is, from what I understand. That being said, also ensuring that what we regulate or don't works in our favor, and also just taking it step by step as we go on. Following up on the earlier question, while the debate on whether governments should regulate first or let innovation take root first goes on, it surely brings home the point that balancing innovation with regulation is vital. So how can Bhutan strike this balance to foster a facilitative environment for innovation to grow, while also mitigating risks and ensuring ethical and responsible use of AI?
Another great question. Look, we've already talked about what I find is the wonderful advantages of putting a national digital identity whole scale on blockchain, right? So you're doing away with a lot of the data privacy, data security, exploitation, data sovereignty issues. So Bhutan is already halfway there. I think the other half then becomes, how do you facilitate and focus on Bhutan's greatest and most pressing problems? So how do you figure out what research to do to solve the most pressing problems? I think that question should be key. And then I think based on existing evidence of social impact and social harm that has been documented in other parts of the world, using the very same technologies that are also being used by the citizens of Bhutan, I think that necessitates that regulation be provided for at least those use cases. For instance, quite simply, social media platforms, are they regulated? And if so, in what way? Those are conversations that Bhutan can already start having. And that is not to say that innovation would be stifled. Bhutan, after all, is a market for tech companies worldwide. And taking its position seriously, albeit a small market, but a significant one, I think Bhutan is in a position to pose some conditions on its consumption of those technology products. Also, I think Bhutan needs to be aware that, you know, that the usual issues that the world is grappling with, such as data protection, such as the surveillance of citizens, all of these are important issues. But I think they need to be understood in the light of Bhutan's information technology, as well as developmental goals. So I think government, instead of saying, well, should we regulate? Should we let people innovate? I think it needs to become a part of a larger conversation about innovation. And that conversation needs to be fostered organically. So this has to be a combination of business support, removing regulatory obstacles, training and upskilling, resource sharing, support provision from the government, and an atmosphere of digital cooperation. Now, Bhutan is not alone in this situation. Many, many countries all around the world are asking the same question. And so one of the things that I think makes a lot of sense is obtaining membership in a group of nations that is asking similar questions and is at similar stages of economic development. I understand that the Digital Cooperation Organization that Saudi Arabia has formed just a few years ago is quickly gaining membership. And I wonder if that would be an interesting avenue for Bhutan to look into, because as a friend of mine, who's an expert on this subject, Aiche, she says, it's really the beginnings of a non-aligned movement for countries who want to develop technology that is fit for purpose. And so maybe the answer to developing regulation in Bhutan actually lies outside, talking to these other countries and what their experience has been.
Definitely. Balancing innovation and regulation is a tightrope walk, and it is crucial, like you pointed out, that policies not only protect, but encourage growth and innovation. And prioritizing our limited resources by addressing the key challenges first, and also implementing regulations on a case-by-case basis, such as the use of social media and data protection. Also, some great advice, such as promoting an atmosphere of digital cooperation, implementing AI literacy programs, and working together with like-minded countries, are definitely some ventures that Tan can delve into. So given your extensive involvement in AI policy development and governance, could you please share some insights into how Bhutan can effectively shape our AI policies to align with ethical principles and national priorities? And in addition, what role do you think think tanks like, for example, RICS play a part in this process?
Sure. Well, first of all, I think RICS is doing a tremendous job hosting these conversations. I think this is exactly the first step that the country needs. And there needs to be a center that can convene thought leaders from various spheres who can bring their heads together and work on the project in a holistic way. You know, the start of the conversation is exactly what you're doing now, is taking a wide-ranging holistic view of context, of needs, of challenges, and saying, where do we go from here, right? Now, when you think of ethical principles, you generally think of doing the right thing. But so for Bhutan, that would have to be working on the flourishing of its citizens. And that is the stated explicit goal of the country. So how would you do that? There's already various means and metrics that are being considered and deployed. And over time, I would be very curious to hear the evaluations that emerge from the deployment of these metrics. But of course, RIGS, as I said, is in a fantastic position to play a role in bringing people and convening conversations, because its mandate is finding the best way of doing things from whatever angle, right? And this is the basis of good governance. So can it, in fact, convene across sectors and disciplines? Can it bring together panels that can learn from the experiences of similar developmental economies, whether they are culturally similar or culturally very different? Can it leverage unique local knowledge and examine what should be preserved and protected and kind of prioritize that in a list of priorities? Because, you know, the country can't do everything all at once, even though it's doing a fantastic job. So these are some of the wide-ranging questions that need to be asked. And I understand from my interaction with GovTech Bhutan that a lot of these questions are already being asked. I think maybe what you need is someone who can convene all these questions together, bring these talking heads to the same table and say, you with your technical hat and you with your legal hat and you with your policy hat and you with your social impact hat, how can you advise us on this cycle of innovation and regulation? And what should we, as such a unique country in such a unique situation, ultimately be doing?
Thank you once again. Some very, very useful advice. We have now come to the last question for this segment. Now, gender equality in AI is becoming a pressing issue, which basically stems from the gender equality problems that are generally prevalent around the world. And I believe AI is just mirroring the gender bias that is in our society. At times like these, it is inspiring to see leaders, particularly women leaders like yourself, working towards bridging the widening gender gaps. How do you think Bhutan can play a part in helping address these concerns to ensure fair, unbiased, and inclusive AI systems?
Well, I mean, it's a very important question, and I'm glad that you're asking it last, because I'm hoping that anyone who listens to our conversation takes it away as something that they can think about further. It's not that AI is worsening existing inequalities in gender alone. It is also that AI is creating new kinds of inequalities. So what we already know is that technology or any kind of, let's say, industrial or economic progress has been viewed through the lens of leaders that have predominantly been men. And this is a historical fact. It's not just the position or the gender parity of women in Bhutan or in the United States or another country today. This is, you know, the universal historic position is that there has been a gender gap between men and women. Now, coming to Bhutan, for all of the wonderful things that it has done, one of the disappointing and shocking things that has happened is that it has fallen precipitously in the Global Gender Gap Index. And these are statistics from last month, right? It's gone very suddenly from 103rd place out of 146 countries to 124th place. I haven't looked at this very closely. I suspect it may be that some metrics have been rearranged, because I don't expect that the position of women in Bhutan has suddenly fallen in society. I don't think that that happens. That's not possible. But at the same time, it looks like it hasn't gotten a lot better either. And that is strange, given that Bhutan has moved so quickly from a lower income to a lower middle income country, that it has had tremendous initiatives for social as well as digital transformation, that the literacy rate has shot up. you know, of course, it has economic problems. It was very badly affected by COVID. The tourism economy was very badly impacted as a result. And we know that there has been an outflow of young and qualified Bhutanese citizens out of the country to seek work elsewhere. So all of this is indicative of something. There is a social change that is afoot in Bhutan. And I don't think that we can find the answers to these very complex problems without placing women at the center of them. Because as Bhutan very well recognizes, when you talk about circularity, when you talk about a sustainable economy, when you talk about economic resilience, when you talk about protection and preservation and further promotion and development of natural ecosystems, women are really at the heart of all of these conversations. If you don't have economic participation of women in whatever capacity, you will not have even progress in the country. So you can do all of the other wonderful things that you as a country are already doing, but if you don't add this very complex problem in the mix, things are not going to get better. Now, let me go back to what I was saying about AI creating new forms of gender disparity. Think about the languages that we're using to develop AI. Predominantly, we're starting with English, right? This is the language that the entire world uses. Due to historical conditions of circumstance, we had British colonies that were widespread, and therefore we have English as the dominant language. In this language, there are certain indications or views of how society should be structured so that, for instance, the technology that we built almost always identifies doctors as male and nurses as female. And if you tell a generative AI model to give you a picture of a doctor, you'll probably get a white male. And then you tell it to give you a picture of a nurse, you'll probably get a female who is not white, who is from a minority race or part of the world, right? Which is really interesting and very indicative. But in addition to that, there are some cultural traditions and customs, such as Bhutan's tradition of hospitality. Bhutanese people are very gracious. They're very kind. I have some wonderful friends from the country, and they always insist on sharing meals. Now, in general, this is not a modern Western concept, and it's certainly not a concept in the countries such as the U.S. where LLMs are being built. So people will eat alone, and it's not considered something that's rude or culturally out of context. It's entirely normal. We can be having conversation. I can be eating my lunch. You can be sitting there without your food, and that's considered totally fine. That is not considered okay in a place like Bhutan. And who are the people who create these conditions for sharing meals together? Predominantly, it is still women. So what you're doing is you're embedding technology that not only, as I said earlier, amplifies existing gender bias, it also neglects to include the role of women currently and therefore perpetuates new forms of gender bias. We don't yet know, we are so early in the process that we don't yet know what cultural impact these imported technologies will have on the rest of the world. And it doesn't seem to be very high on anyone's list either. But if Bhutan is really serious about preserving and protecting its wonderful culture, then it needs to take a closer look at AI and gender disparity.
Thank you. Again, a lot to digest, but very rightfully pointed out. And like you mentioned, addressing gender biases in AI is indeed very critical, especially given the times that we are living in right now. And ensuring inclusivity and fairness in AI systems can greatly benefit our societal structures. There's a lot to delve into, especially concerning equality and women participation in AI or any other field. And I think we should definitely do a totally different episode on that topic. We've come to the end of the episode. Before we close off, do you have any other comments or topics that you'd like to discuss today?
Yeah, thank you so much, Yeshe, for this opportunity to have a final word. I think what I would want to leave you with is the words of Amartya Sen, who is an economist, a very prominent economist who works on issues of inequality. He says, and I paraphrase, I don't remember the exact phrase, but he says that in order to achieve equality for all, you must first provide unequal or favorable treatment to those that have been unequal for so long. And so equality or inequality is not, it's not a standard definition. It changes according to context. And in a place like Bhutan that is making so many strides in so many areas, but yet is still struggling with things like circularity or with women's participation. I think that is a good consideration to keep in mind as AI and an innovation ecosystem develop in the country.
Thank you so much once again for being part of the RICS podcast, despite your very, very tight schedule. And I, for one, have undoubtedly learned a lot from you, and I'm sure that our listeners back home will do so too. And it has been a great honor and an absolute pleasure talking to you today. So thank you so much.
You're so welcome. And I'm very honored to be featured on your podcast.